So we find that loneliness is a problem for all age groups, but there are two groups in particular that really wrestle: 30 to 49 year olds and 16 to 24 year olds.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile. This is Premier Christian Radio and I'm Emma Fowle. The Profile is the show where we sit down with a well-known Christian to hear more about their life, their faith and their ministry. It is brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine, Premier Christianity. Head over to premierchristianity.com/podcast for your exclusive half-price subscription offer. Today on the show, I'm joined by broadcaster and writer Sheridan Voisey. Sheridan has hosted a national radio show in his native Australia and is a regular contributor to Radio 2's Thought for the Day. He's the author of 7 books and has written for many publications, including this one. On today's podcast, he shares about giving up his career as a club DJ and how he and his wife dealt with infertility. He also tells me about his latest project, which explores the importance of friendships. Now, Sheridan, your website says that you love to help people craft deeply meaningful lives. I think that is so beautiful. And that you do that through a variety of ways, but including exploring the idea of personal vocation and how this is shaped by our own stories and experiences. So I thought it would be only right to start this interview by asking you about the story that has shaped Sheridan. Could you tell us a little bit about your upbringing and how you came to faith?
Okay. I was born in Australia to British parents. I actually had a British accent, which you can imagine how well that went down in a little Cleveland primary school where the kids did not know where on earth I was coming from. So I struggled a bit in primary school, I have to say. I was not accepted, but I was always this kind of slightly odd character. At the same time, I was an only child up until the age of 13 when my one and only sibling, my brother, came along. And then to top it off, on top of that, at the time, my parents were involved in one of the very well-known religious cults as well. So I was just on the outer and I did not connect in. And, you know, I think a lot of us look back at our primary school years and for some of us, it might be really, really glowing times. I look at those years as being really difficult times, and I'm more than happy that I moved past those. Things got better for me in terms of relationships and things in high school. You know, I always had a close friend and I had a little group of people to sit with at lunchtime. But boy, those primary school years, they were lonely old years. And I think, Emma, that is part of the thing that God uses to shape you, which is obviously the reason behind your question, because so many things were, I think, embedded then, that sense of wanting to bring the outsiders in, wanting to connect.
So you grew up as part of a cult. How did you get out of that and how did you journey towards Jesus?
Beautiful story there. Long story short, it really wasn't me. It was my wonderful mum who had been a missionary overseas with this group. My dad had been a local area missionary in London before they both had then emigrated out to Australia. And my mum had, they'd both kind of come to not a crisis of faith, but they had had a lot of alarm bells ringing over the years. And the cult was the Jehovah's Witnesses. And what had happened was that they'd been in it for such a long time that they started to be able to see where the Watchtower organization started contradicting itself. Now, remember, this is an organization that says that it is the one true church. Its publications were the only source of validated truth about the divine. And over the years, they were starting to be able to see, hang on a sec, you're saying this now, but 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you were saying exactly the opposite. Little alarm bells were starting to ring for them. Now, the problem with a lot of these kinds of organizations is that you cannot question them. You are not allowed to doubt. And if you do start to doubt, then you are considered, quote unquote, spiritually sick. So it becomes a very difficult position to be in because you can't go anywhere else to ask questions, but then you're not able to ask questions of the people who are supposed to give you the answers in a way that will be objective. So mum and dad stopped going along to meetings. They were still connected we would still go along at what in the church we would call Easter time, what in that organization you call the memorial. So they would still go there every year. I was kind of raised during this 10 years of doubt that they had, where they weren't exactly sure what to teach me, but they did teach me just general good morals and good values. But it wasn't enough for my mum. And she had to know who Jesus was, because she had been taught, and of course she had taught, that he was ultimately not God in the flesh. He was the Archangel Michael in disguise. And something was niggling at her. And so for a good 3 years, she would sit down on her bed every morning. She would open up three copies of the Bible. She had the New World Translation, which of course was the only one she was supposed to be reading. She had a Catholic Douay version that somebody had given her, which she really shouldn't have had. And then she had a Good News Bible that she was given at Expo 88 in Brisbane when it came from one of the big Christian organizations there that had been handing out Bibles. And so she would open up the Bible and she would read it in these three versions with the one prayer, Jehovah, show me who Jesus is. She also had a copy of the New World Translation's Interlinear Bible, which I'm not too sure they actually still produce, but this had the Greek on one page and the English translation, the New World Translation, on the right. And one day she was reading John 8:58, where Jesus says, in all other Christian translations, before Abraham was, I am. In the New World Translation, it's been changed to before Abraham was, I have been. Now, of course, if you're the Archangel Michael, you existed before Abraham. So that makes sense. You existed before Ham. But if you are the I am, then of course that's a reference to Exodus 3:14, where God actually introduces himself to Moses and says, I am who I am. It's a direct reference to Jesus being God. And what had been happened is that in the New World Translation it had been changed, but it hadn't been changed in the direct interlinear version. And so Mum read that, had a real aha moment, and that coincided with a whole bunch of people that had been praying for her for years. And she ended up going to a woman's coffee morning at a local Baptist church. And she wasn't allowed to go to a Baptist church, of course, but when she heard that this little meeting was going to be held in the meeting hall, the fellowship hall next to the church, she thought, oh, well, maybe it's okay if I just go into that room and not into the main room, you know, it might be okay. So she went along this one morning, and this lady gave this talk, and she was painting a picture, and she was saying, look, this is what it's like when God is in control of our lives. And she was painting this beautiful picture. And then she took a paintbrush, dabbed it with black paint, and then she destroyed it. She said, this is what happens when we take control of our lives. And at the end of that meeting, she started praying this prayer. She said, Lord, if there's any woman here who is struggling with her faith, and when you listen to the cassette back, because it's an old tape, you start hearing this woman in the background crying, and then she starts to weep, and then she starts to wail. And that's my mother. And at that moment, all of these ladies that were at this coffee morning gathered around her, put their arms around her, and she knew she was home. She discovered who Jesus was. She'd felt this love through all these women's hands. And she came home and she said, I found the answer. And so she put in her resignation. About 3 months later, my dad had his own kind of epiphany with God. And then I was watching all that, trying to find my life in nightclubs.
So how old were you at this point when your mother converted?
This is 89, so I would have been 17. And I was going into DJ nightclubs and DJ competitions around about this time, trying to find my meaning and my purpose in the nightclub scene, starting to get some success, but it not touching me inside. Start to see this change that's going on for Mum and Dad, and I start to see them look like they've suddenly been taking happy pills. And that just makes a real impression on me, and then I ended up following through and coming through to faith.
Wow, that's a really cool story, especially, you know, at that age, having grown up with that uncertainty and coming through Jehovah's Witnesses. Often when you come out of those types of cults, it's a really hard and negative and painful experience.
And it was.
You could have run away. You could have run a mile, but somehow through that process, you actually found yourself drawn to Christ.
I think I was given a real grace, because I grew up in that 10 years of doubt for Mum and Dad. So, you know, I didn't have the same kind of upbringing as other people who were born into it. But at the same time, Emma, it has given me a lifelong sensitivity to truth, mm-hmm. because you recognize that error is damaging for the soul. It can be damaging eternally for the soul. But boy, it can be just so damaging to a person, to relationships. Mum and Dad said at one stage they may well have broken up during those 10 years because it was just so difficult. My mum really wrestled with her mental health during that time. And then when they left, well, of course, they were shunned by all these people that had been their family for decades. So the cost has been huge, but of course the rewards have been immense.
And how did it work out for you as a young man at that stage? You just said you were DJing in nightclubs and doing all of that kind of thing. Was there a clash of lifestyle choices for you at that point? Or did you find a way to, I mean, I love clubbing and I'm a Christian, I'm just going to say it. So always have done. I find house music to be quite a spiritual experience, if I'm being 100% honest. So I don't necessarily see there being a particular divide, but nonetheless, the lifestyle is one that comes with certain temptations and difficulties. How did that play out for you?
Yeah, really good question. So I wrestled for a bit. So I made this initial commitment to Christ. And because DJing was still so important in my life, it turned out that there was actually an arm wrestle of gods going on in my case. And I still wanted to be back in the clubs. And for others, like you've just said, it would have been fine. For me, it wasn't. So I actually had to have a fairly dramatic exit. I mean, in a case of, you know, smashing thousands of dollars worth of records to actually break the idol that was over me at that stage. And it was only at that point when I was then free. Emma, some of the classic, the absolute rare 12 inches that I destroyed on that day. When I look back now, I go, if only I had that copy. But no, it was the important thing for me to do with my spiritual life. I wouldn't have progressed. Certainly wouldn't have done everything that I've done now if there hadn't been that kind of crisis moment of saying, no, it's all or nothing. And really actually going cold turkey for about 3 or 4 years where I didn't listen to any house music. I didn't listen to anything like that because it was just for me too tempting to go back into that old way of life. And I needed to make a clean break. Now, man, I'm a soul and funk guy, and I still love soulful house. I've got no problem because I'm free and now I can enjoy it. Because it's not going to take me back to Egypt.
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate, actually, isn't it? Those types of questions. I had a friend growing up when I was in my teens at my youth group who would not listen to secular radio because she said for her, it just was not okay. It disrupted her spiritual walk. She just found she couldn't handle it. She didn't like listening to secular music. And then, yeah, like you say, for others, it's a different type of idol. So it's one of those things that's very personal, isn't it? And it's interesting that sometimes within the church, it becomes a very black and white issue. And certainly for me growing up, I always felt like slightly too naughty for youth group because I liked going clubbing, but slightly too good for my non-Christian friends because I also didn't take drugs. So sometimes you just fall in the middle of all worlds, don't you?
That's right. I remember somebody said, you know, if you're really going to be missional, you're going to be right on the edge of a lack of orthodoxy, you know, right on the edge of heresy. Because yes, you're going to be too conservative for your radical friends that are out there. Are doing all sorts of stuff, way too conservative for them. You're going to be a little bit naughty to the conservative folks who are in your church. So it comes down to is it going to be a block with your walk with God? Is it going to then lead others astray with the way that you're leading? I think that the law of love that we are called to live out is basically the way that we make those ethical decisions. Is this going to be something that detracts from my love of God and love of other people? Or in fact, is it because I've got the equipment to do it, I'm able to go in, I'm actually able to love God and love other people in those contexts in which maybe other people just aren't able to get into.
So tell me about the move into broadcasting. You've obviously had a long and illustrious career in the media. How did that come about?
Quite by surprise. I had no interest in radio whatsoever. If you're in nightclubs, you're not interested in talking, you're interested in mixing. You're interested in beats, you're interested in laser lights, throbbing, you know, bass lines that are, you know, rumbling the whole of the city. You're not interested in 3-minute songs and then talking for 40 seconds and then playing ads. It was as a result, after having made that commitment, of starting to pray about the direction that my life should take. And Emma, it took 2 years without any direction at all of prayer to then have this calling into radio. So I was kind of basically in my room for two years, of course, doing work and everything, but okay, God really showed me, what am I supposed to do with my life? I had no idea, now that I'd let go of this kind of big dream of going to nightclubs and winning competitions and things. And then one day I was really struck by the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you'll find. Knock on the door and it will be opened to you. And I realized, you know what? I haven't been asking, seeking, knocking. Seeking guidance and direction for the Christian is actually an active process, not just simply a passive one of praying and waiting. Both are actually involved. And around about that time, somebody had come to our church and talked about one of the overseas missionary broadcasters that were taking the gospel, you know, spreading it out by shortwave at that stage right across the world. And so I just found this strange beating of my heart, and I wondered whether there was something to follow in that. So I wrote a letter to the director of one of those organizations in Australia. And it was really funny, Emma, because, you know, I said, look, I'm not sure, but I think maybe God might be calling me into radio. And at that stage, I was thinking it was going to be production behind the scenes, twiddling knobs. And I said, well, I'm assuming I'm going to need some sort of Bible training, and I guess I'll probably need some sort of radio experience or something. Can you offer me anything at your offices? Now, I was living in Brisbane at the time. This guy was in Melbourne. And I had in my mind, you know, this huge radio complex with studios and producers and all sorts of things, maybe even a Bible college attached to it. It took me 2 weeks to get a reply from John. His name was John Reeder. And during that 2 weeks, I had this strange experience. I had these two dominant thoughts that would not leave my mind. First thought was, you should get in contact with the Bible College of Queensland, and I should make contact with Family Radio. Now, Family Radio by that stage was a little Christian radio station. It didn't have a license. It was able to get a little bit of time each morning, a couple of hours in the morning, 1 hour in the afternoon, by buying it from another community station that did have a license. I had listened to it. I was, of course, not impressed. And I had these two feelings, these two thoughts. Bible College of Queensland, Family Radio. Bible College of Queensland, Family Radio. 2 weeks later, I get John Reeder's response in the mail. And John says, hi, Sheridan. Great to hear about your walk with God and everything, and maybe you're calling into radio. Actually, I'm just a two-person office down here. I don't have any studios or anything. But if I were you, I'd make contact with the Bible College of Queensland and Family Radio.
Wow, that's specific.
And so I went. I had an interview with the principal of the Bible College of Queensland. He was showing me around. And while he was showing me around, he points to a little building that's a little bit further down the hill on their campus. And he said, oh, and that's the offices of Family Radio. And around here is this and around here. I said, what? Turned out they're on the same piece of land. Didn't even know it. I ended up going down there, meeting them. And before I knew it, I had this calling into radio. And it wasn't going to be behind the scenes twiddling knobs. It was going to be on air before the mic.
Wow, that is incredible. What a cool story. Isn't it beautiful? And God is that good to us that he gives those such specific like clarifications and leadings.
Isn't that lovely? Yeah, clearest guidance I've ever had in my life.
And of course, I mean, you've written 7 books, and all of your books tell a lot of your own personal story, including the story of how you did that for many years and how you eventually gave that up to come to the UK. And part of that is tied to your and your wife's personal story of infertility and how that played out for you guys and how you walked through the pain of coming to terms with that. And you laying that down so that your wife could follow her dream, which was to work overseas. Would you mind sharing a little bit of that story with us for those who haven't read your books and don't know that part of your story?
Yeah. So, I mean, things in radio just went really, really wonderfully. And so we ended up moving from Brisbane to Perth in Western Australia, the most isolated city in the world, for me to do the morning show over at a radio station over there. From there, later on, I then ended up moving to Sydney to launch a nationally syndicated show called Open House, which was very much connecting with the Australian secular heart, but bringing Christian faith into it. And it was a huge dream come true, a 10-year dream, in fact, that had come true. But during that same 10 years, we had had this dream of having a child, and it just wasn't happening. We had tried everything we felt comfortable trying. And we thought right at the end of those 10 years that we actually had what we'd been hoping and praying for, when on our very last embryo transfer from our very last round of IVF after we'd already had a conversation saying, look, if it doesn't work, we've tried everything. We've tried adoption. We've tried IVF. We've tried healing prayer. We've tried diets. We've tried special supplements. We've tried everything. We need to move on. On that very last embryo, we were told that we were pregnant. And we had our family and friends around the country who'd been praying for us for 10 years, you know, in tears of jubilation and tears of joy. And then on Christmas Eve of 2010, of all moments, we had a call from the IVF clinic saying, I'm so sorry, you're not pregnant. And that was the cruel twist that kind of brought that whole thing to an end. We went back to Sydney. We'd been in Brisbane when we got the call, went back to Sydney, started thinking about what the future could look like. And Merrin had said, look, the only other thing I've wanted to do with my life apart from becoming a mum is to live and work overseas. And it just seemed like, because our infertility was on my side, I'm the biological cause of us not having children, I carried a lot of guilt about that. If you're in that situation, you'll know you feel responsible for your wife not having what she wants, for your wife sobbing, shuddering in your arms sometimes because she can't have what she wants. And you're the biological cause for that. So when you've got an opportunity to give her a dream that she could have, will you want to give it to her? But it meant letting go of the national show, which itself had been a dream come true, and speaking opportunities and publishing contracts. And I knew that if we were going to move to another country, that all would basically take a long time to rebuild. Long story short, we ended up making that move. This is all told in a story in a book called Resurrection Year. And it was difficult, I have to say, Emma, for the first 2 or 3 years. It was very, very difficult because I was starting again. And I didn't know who I was or what I was on this earth to do. The speaking engagements weren't there. The national radio show certainly wasn't there. BBC weren't returning my phone calls at that stage. I thought I had a really good idea for a book, and I had publishers turning me down because they said, well, who's Sheridan Voysey? We haven't heard of him over here. And one actually said, come back to us when you're famous. So it was a difficult time, but... through that, we have seen God do some amazing things. And I can honestly say that it's in those moments when life doesn't go as planned, that that is the time when God is shaping you to be the people that he really wants you to be and really preparing you for an opportunity to serve others in ways you otherwise never could. It really is an opportunity for you to become the person that you're supposed to be and for you to take that kind of deep disappointment and recycle it into service to others.
Yeah, and you talk about that quite a lot on your website and other things I've heard you say and other things I've read that you've written about that idea of recycling adversity. And we know, actually, don't we, as Christians, that's a deeply biblical idea. It's sewn into stories like the story of Joseph. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, nonetheless, if you're in a deep place of pain and you can't see your way to that point at that point in time, it's very growth mindset, isn't it? Have you ever had people push back on that and be like, OK, Sheridan, that's fine for you, that you can manage to see the good in this. I can't right now. What do I do with that?
Yeah, I mean, we all know it theoretically, don't we? Because you're absolutely right. It's right through the pages of Scripture. It's when you have to find it experientially, and you've got to prove it to yourself. Absolutely. I mean, for myself, for some years, I was kind of wondering, okay, is that it? Those 5 years hosting Open House, was that as good as it got? And now it's basically a case of, well, I'll just do, you know, I'll pick up the scraps afterwards. And so there are often times, and even still today, there are often times where you kind of go, oh, it's still not working out the way I wanted it to work out. And yet that is the time. So have I had pushback on that? I have not had so much pushback. What I have is an opportunity from people who read the books, who read Resurrection Year and read The Making of Us, which is the follow-on that really looks into this, who are not there yet and are in the process. And they're saying, can it truly be true? Can it really be true? And I hope, Emma, that the last thing I do is say yes to them. I hope instead what I actually do is listen to them and help to journey alongside them, because the easy yes is too much of a platitude for people who are right in that moment. It really, really is. And so you've just got to walk alongside people. And for some, it takes a long time. This is a fallen world. And for some, the loss is just so great that it can take a while to actually get through. And yet I look at those people, and I look then at the way that they listen to others. I look at the way that they pray for others. And I look at the way that they somehow have this incredible sense of wisdom in which they pass it on to other people in conversations. And I say, look at that. There are the seeds of it. That's the first shoots of it. This is what I'm talking about. This is the you that you couldn't otherwise have been, and the you that God is using to now actually start reaching into other people's lives. So that's what we've got to do. Walk with people empathetically and help them and be incredibly humble about it, because we've all still got our unfinished business in our own lives too.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's what the Bible's talking about, isn't it? It says that we comfort with the comfort that we ourselves have received. And, you know, that's the phenomenal thing about you and your wife being prepared to share your story so honestly, because it's not platitude when it comes from someone who has walked a mile in your shoes, is it? It's kind of, I know how that feels, and it's taken me time, but we've got through it, and here's the lessons I've learned. And they're important conversations, and they're conversations that don't always get had. And especially for you, you know, like hearing you talk about the guilt that you felt as a man, you know, those are very deeply entrenched things, like deep identity stuff, that especially for guys is actually quite difficult to process and express at times, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, segueing nicely into your latest project about friendships, you know, these are some of the things that I assume that you're probably starting to find when you're researching friendships. Would you talk to us a little bit about that project, and specifically about the things that relate to the differences between how men and women process friendships and process some of those painful stories?
Well, actually, there's a couple of projects that speak to what you're asking about, because another book that we've just released, which is a collaborative book, is called Praying Through Infertility. And actually, some of the male contributors to that book, it's a 90-day devotional, and some of the male contributors to that book have done an incredible job of helping to get into that male psyche when it comes to this particular topic, which impacts our masculinity so much, and also touches on the whole British stiff upper lip that so many of us have been raised with, right? Where you just can't share those kinds of things. So I would commend that to anybody who, in particular, who's walking through this field of infertility, do not know, especially as a man, how do I even put words to the emotions that I'm experiencing? Sometimes we've got to go through a whole journey of making those connections. But then when it comes to friendship, gosh, I mean, it's a huge need right now. Every fourth person that you pass in the street has no close friends. And the 10th person you pass has no friends at all. So we've got a huge need, and that is echoed not just here in the UK, it's echoed in Australia, in the United States. And in fact, the Gallup organization recently came out with a poll that said 25% of the world is lonely. So we've got a huge need right now. And the way that we are able to connect with others, one of those ways is actually through vulnerability. Now, you don't do it with a person you've just met down at the bus stop. This is something that grows, and it grows until trust is born. But when you do that, when you get the courage to be able to share, you know what? I'm not doing well today. Thank you for asking. And no, I'm not going to give the platitude the regular answer, which is, yes, I'm fine. No, I'm actually not doing particularly well today. In that moment of honesty, that moment of vulnerability, a little thread starts to be wound between you and the other person. And the more we can be like that, the more threads that we can weave between the two of us, and the more ties that we're going to have that will bind us together. So vulnerability is a whole, there's about four kind of key factors when it comes to developing close friendships. There's expressing affection to each other. There is vulnerability. There's shared experiences. There's things like gratitude, making sure that you always thank the person that you have as your friend, either because of what they've just done very practically or because of who they are. Those things actually help to weave these threads so that we can be... Friendship is like a beautiful garment. The tighter the weave, the more the threads, the stronger it is and the warmer it's going to become. And I think the more threads that we can weave, then the better.
And those stats that you just said are startling and frankly quite depressing and scary. Are they, is that broadly across all age ranges, or are there some that are worse than others?
So we find that loneliness is a problem for all age groups, but there are two groups in particular that really wrestle: 30 to 49 year olds and 16 to 24 year olds. So those are the two loneliest. And you would kind of think, oh, hang on, isn't it the single older person, you know, who is?
Yeah, that would have been exactly my guess. If you'd asked me, I'd have said, oh,
exactly. That's right. But it's not. It's not. Now, remember, the loneliness levels for all age groups are high. So yes, they are also lonely. But those are the two loneliest groups. 16 to 24, we know there's all sorts of reasons there. A good deal of that is to do with smartphones that has a major part in that. Not the only part by any means. And smartphones are not the complete enemy. But very good research coming out from Jonathan Haidt and others about the impact of that. For 30 to 49, look, the fact is, we've never been taught how to make friends. We have courses, we have books, we have seminars, we have whole ministries, whole organizations, whole charities that are dedicated to marriage and family life. We have nothing for friendship. Friendship is hardly ever touched on in the school curriculum. It's mainly sex education. We hardly talk about it in our public conversations. We primarily talk about sex and romance and relationships in those ways. We, all of us know by heart, we know the date of Valentine's Day. Nobody knows the date of International Friendship Day. And my goal, one day, it's July 30th, just so you know. Scribble it down. You can impress your friends next time I ask it.
I'm going to be making a note.
That's exactly right. My goal is that we're going to change that with this new charity called Friendship Lab. We're going to see that change so that we can have these conversations. So by the time you reach your 30s, and maybe you've gotten married, you've almost certainly moved away from home for work or university, you're out of university, so you're not in regular contact with people because you don't have the same kind of timetable, you're not all gathered around the same geographical area anymore. Maybe you've had children. Before you know it, all those ties that you made in high school and in university, they're all gone, and you don't have the time to actually keep them going. So that's one of the reasons why the 30 to 49-year-old is struggling so much in this area.
I find this whole area fascinating. I've got 1,000 questions I would like to ask you. But that's really interesting. My husband and I have reflected on this ourselves quite a lot, actually. We are in that age bracket. I have children in the other age bracket, so we're hitting both target groups here.
Right.
And, you know, we've often said, oh, you know, these very, very strong, intense relationships that you had at school, at college, at university, now I find my friendships out of the sort of five or so really close good friends I had at university. Two of us live in two. So we're now spread across three different countries. We have a whole ocean in between, three of us here in the UK and two of us in America and Canada. It becomes really difficult, doesn't it? Once you've got those pulls on your time of full-time work, you're not living together like you used to when you were 19. You've got family, you've got kids, all of those things. And suddenly you find, even though they were very intense relationships and very, very deep, and you went very deep very quickly, perhaps because, like you said, you were sharing this very intense bonding experience together and you spent a lot of time together when you were at university and living together, suddenly it becomes so much harder to maintain those relationships and trying to replace them with ones that are equally deep when you're meeting people in your 30s and have all these other pulls in your time becomes really difficult. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing this is what your course is going to teach us.
Very much so. Very much so. If we can be intentional, you can both keep those contacts that are now, you know, spread across three different countries. You can keep those as well as you can nurture new friendships as well. You have to be intentional. You have to prioritize it. That's half the problem, is that most of the time we haven't been intentional or we haven't prioritised it. I remember a moment back in 2008, sitting in a seminar room, it was on fostering and adoption, and the straight-talking seminar leader said, look, fostering and adoption is hard work. You're going to need a support group around you. And then she asked this question. She said, who can you call at 2 a.m. when everything has gone wrong? And my pen was hovering over that workbook, and I did not know who to write in. And that was my moment of realizing, I'm not being intentional about this. I'm not placing this high enough in the priorities list. So we have to do that. But yes, you can keep those geographically distant relationships close, emotionally close, and you can then nurture the other relationships you have around you, but it takes time. Research suggests it takes at least 50 hours of meaningful contact to move from acquaintance to casual friend alone, let alone moving then to friend and close friend and really close friend. That's another 200 hours. So you've got to invest a lot, which means we have to go back to that intentionality and prioritizing of it in our lives. And yeah, the Friendship Lab course, we've gone and spent years now actually working on this course. We piloted it last year with a group of 80 people in four different countries. And we had a researcher from the University of Leicester come and do a deep dive with 20 participants, do pre and post interviews with them to work out whether it worked. Thankfully, Emma, I can say that it worked. And we're going to be launching publicly in February of 2025.
It's really interesting because I completely agree. Like I've attended marriage courses, I've attended parenting courses. I have no problem with that. I think that's a really positive thing. And actually, I think that's one thing that the church in particular does really well, is places
really
a high value
well
on those things and champions
really
those
well
things. And, you know, those courses have come out of the church. But when I first heard about a friendship course, I was reading about it on your website, I was like, I don't need someone to teach me how to make friends. This feels like, you know, bubbles something up inside of something. Think, oh, but that should just happen. That should be natural. We shouldn't have to work at that thing, surely. But, you know, when you unpack it a little bit, like we just have, you start to think, well, why shouldn't you have to prioritize that relationship as well? And I wonder if, particularly within the church, we don't do this very well because we place such a high emphasis. I've heard a lot of single people say the church places too much emphasis on marriage and on, you know, that relationship, and it leaves single people out. Do we place too much emphasis there? And also then you bring into the male-female mix and the whole kind of church scandal, oh, we mustn't be friends with, you know, boys and girls, and how do we do that well? Are we just in a place where we've lost the plot and we don't know how to do this well anymore?
Oh, my goodness. Well, just on the first little point you mentioned there, we should just be able to do this. That whole, you know, friendship should just be organic and it should just kind of happen, and we should just all happen to know. That's the biggest myth about friendship that we've all fallen for, and I've fallen for it as well. So let's kind of pull that out and put that into the light. When it comes to church, let's work on the positives. There is no other organization on the face of this earth that every week brings a variety of different people from different backgrounds, in many cases different ethnic and racial backgrounds, together in the one place regularly. The closest thing we have is a local sports group, you know, your sports club. But we have these wonderful opportunities because we do that. We've got the opportunities of meeting people in a large group on a Sunday, you know, for most churches. Normally there's opportunities to meet a smaller group of people and get to know them a little bit more, say small groups during the middle week. Sometimes you might find, you know, a couple of people that you want to pray with, you'll get to know them even closer again. So there's wonderful gifts that the church brings when it comes to friendship. The barriers are there. One of them is just what you've said, that single people wrestle with so much because the emphasis is so much about marrying and then siring children that, well, what happens then to the single person? They wrestle, or then we've got to have special singles groups so that they're catered for. No, if we are to look at friendship, then we actually solve a whole bunch of problems just like that. The second thing I would say is that, again, it's a positive that if we leave it there, it becomes a negative. But we've been very good at community as well. I think that's the other thing. We're very good at marriage courses, and we need those. But we've also been very, very good at community. We're able to bring a variety of different people together, get them to meet, get them to worship together. When you're worshiping together, you're focusing on something else apart from each other and apart from yourselves. That's all very, very good. But community is not enough. Community is diffused. It's you as a part of a group. Within that group, I still need 3, 4 close friends who I can really share with, who I can really share those moments of vulnerability with. And this actually touches on a historic barrier that there has been in churches to friendship. And this goes back actually to 12th, 13th, 14th century in the church, where the monasteries started to look very negatively about friendship because they said, hang on a sec, it doesn't seem right when Jesus said that we are to love all people indiscriminately, that we should then have this preference for one or two people. And the way that outworked in the monastery was, well, you shouldn't really be really close to David and to Jonathan when there's another 12 brothers, I'm just using that as an example, another 12 brothers in whom you are to be close brothers and friends with. And so actually, we've inherited something of a question mark about friendship historically, probably without us even realizing it. This also ties back, I'm going to give you a long answer to this, but I hope it's interesting.
That's
for
brilliant.
You, Emma.
It's fascinating.
We've also misunderstood love. So there was a very, very influential book, which none of us have read, but all of us have been influenced by a theologian named Anders Nygren. And he wrote a book some years ago, it's actually back in the 1930s, called Agape and Eros. And that's where we get a lot of our thinking about the different Greek words for love. Agape, he said, agape is this wonderful, good, godly, pure, self-sacrificial love. That's the love we are supposed to do. It is indiscriminate versus eros, which is this terrible, fallen, human love, which only loves another person because of what we can get from them or because of what we desire in them or because they're nice looking, etc., etc. Now, where did he put philia, which is a Greek word for friendship? Where did he put philia? He put it under eros. So he basically said that friendship is a diminished form of love. It's not a true form of love. And again, I think all of this has been little streams that have gone into the big river, of which we've then started to understand, well, the greatest thing in all of this is sacrificial love. How many sermons have you heard, Emma, on sacrificial love?
Over a lot.
Your Christian life?
A lot. Yeah.
I bet you've heard probably a whole bunch of sermons on sex and eros too, right?
Not so many.
Okay, not so many. But, not as many as sacrifice, yeah. But there would have been a few, particularly in youth group and particularly, you know, young adults groups and things like that.
For sure.
How many sermons have you heard on friendship?
Maybe none. maybe exactly. A few people mention David and Jonathan, like you just said.
David and Jonathan.
But yeah.
Peter, James and John. So, yeah. Exactly. This is part of it, is we have not spoken about friendship. We haven't talked about it. We haven't emphasized it. We certainly haven't preached on it.
Yeah. And maybe some of that, you know, often the thing that comes up that becomes a tension is this sort of idea of, oh, you don't want to form too many cliques. You know, often
exactly.
You get this debate with home groups, don't you? Do we let people select their own groups? Do we mix them up? Do we make sure they move? We don't want... But there is something in us that naturally gravitates towards a person and doesn't gravitate towards another. Is that okay? Is it just,
if we were to follow
that instinct, or do we need to try to create some kind of different community?
Look, it is a great thing for us to wrestle with, because it is one of the great tensions. The monks back in the 13th century were not all wrong. When we do kind of form cliques, what happens is, what's the negative side of that? It excludes other people. We don't want to do that. I don't believe we are called to be people who are completely all about philia. I think we are supposed to be people of agape as well. We are to be people who offer indiscriminate love. We are to be people who go the extra mile, reach the least and the lost and the left out. There is that little child in me who still goes back to those experiences in primary school. I want to bring the outsiders in and get them into the inside. So that is a good thing. But what happened for me, Emma, is that because that was emphasized so much, especially with my background, and then when I came and became a Christian and I heard all of these sermons about sacrificial love, is that part of the reason why I diminished friendship in my life is because I thought exactly the same thing. I shouldn't be spending time with friends. I should always be reaching out to the people who aren't yet those people who are in the church. We can have both. If Jesus didn't want this, well, he wouldn't have then siphoned off Peter, James and John to spend a little bit more time with them. And in fact, I would suggest there's some other friends in Jesus' life that we have forgotten all about, and that is Martha, Mary, and and Lazarus. If you look at that story across Luke and John, you will find that Jesus really enjoyed the company of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. He spends, basically, he probably camps there whenever he's going through Bethany. Probably, you know, they give him a bed in their, you know, three-bedroom flat. And, you know, they throw parties for him. You find that in the Gospel of John. You find that he is spending time with them, even though they weren't part of the 12 disciples. They weren't part of the 72 disciples, the larger group. They weren't Jesus' colleagues. They were his friends. And if Jesus was able to have a few close friends, then I think we're allowed to as well. Now, did that stop Jesus from reaching out to other people? In no way. We can have both. There's some people that are close to us. They know us intimately. They're able to keep us accountable. They're able to help us to grow. And most importantly, they fill our tanks so that we have the energy then to reach out to those other people around us.
So I love this idea that you talk about the 2 a.m. friend. That's an absolutely brilliant sort of measure, isn't it, of do I have those people that I really have intimate relationships with in my life that I can call on any time of night or day to rescue me out of a tight spot? So as an, you know, when that happened to you and you said that you found yourself hovering and not really knowing who to write down, where did you go from that? What did you do in your life, especially as an adult male moving continents, to put that intimacy back into your life?
Well, of course, I hadn't done Friendship Lab back then, so I didn't know what to do. But what the first thing I did was actually put my friends' birthdays into my Outlook, so that at the very least, I was able to remember and then contact them on the day and celebrate their very existence, the genesis of them coming into this world. And I put a 2-week reminder on it, so that if for those friends who were interstate, there was time for me to procrastinate and do all the things that I normally do when it comes to getting a card and sending the card and putting it in the mail. But that was the most practical, tangible thing that I could think to do straight away. And from that point on, it led to other things. So we then arranged walking trips and hiking and camping events. So two of these friends were, again, back in Brisbane. I was in Sydney by this stage. And so we arranged for twice a year. I would either go up to them, they would come down to me, and we would have kind of these moments together. I would be a little bit more intentional about putting in conversations with other people, whether it be in person or whether it be Skype calls back then. But being intentional about that. These days, I would give you these little bits of advice. I would say work on check-ins, catch-ups, and meet-ups. So a check-in is just a little text, a WhatsApp message, how you doing, how did the job interview go, are you feeling better now? That's going to take you all of 10 seconds. A catch-up is just a quick phone call. Don't make it any more than 8 or 9 minutes. Just basically call up and say, hey, mate, just calling you. I've got no reason. I just want to see how you're doing today. Just keep it short so that it's not a burdensome, but something really, really, really quick. You can do that via video phone as well. That's fine. And then a meetup is actually getting together in the same room to have that coffee, to go for that walk, to play that game of football, whatever. If you work on those three things, then you will start to build the time that adds up to those 50 hours that move those people across the friendship timeline.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I was talking to a friend the other day and she said that she finds it quite intimidating when she has friends who she loves and who she's had in her life for years, that she now lives some distance away from, that call her. And often she doesn't answer because she doesn't have the time at that point to have a long conversation. And so she said she manages that with her close friends by basically they've agreed exactly what you just said, that they will call regularly, but they will give each other permission to say, basically, they'll text first to say, I'm going to give you a call. Are you free? And she'll say, yes, I've got 10 minutes. And they both then know, like, this is okay. I can answer this call, but it really won't go beyond 10 minutes because, I don't know, I'm in the middle of cooking dinner for the family, or I have to go pick a child up from a club.
So I love the fact that there's negotiation going on there, because that's really important, that there's the openness to have the negotiation. This is the way we'll do it. We'll text first and then find out. And you have permission to actually say, no, it's not the right time.
My husband recently changed job and he now has to drive to the office 2 days a week. And he said to me a little while ago, I'm going to use that phone call to make sure I catch up with my two best friends every week. He's, you know, he won't mind me saying this on national radio. He's a proper middle class white repressed male. Like, he doesn't do emotions. But he's like, I'm going to do it. I'm putting myself out there. We're
Now
going to.
tell us his faults.
But you know that was his he suddenly had this light bulb moment that I don't want to lose these friendships, and I'm in my mid-40s, and if I don't do something about it, we are just going to drift apart.
Yeah. I love it. See, that's the other thing too, is that when you have when you get to kind of stage three on the kind of the timeline that we have for friendships, when you get to that kind of we are friends now and we want to then move to being close friends, one of the big things that you can do is have a regular meetup time. And so it might be just like what your husband does there. This is the time when I call that friend and the other friend, you know. So that's regular. That's happening every week or every month. Doesn't really matter about the frequency, as long as it's really enjoyable for both of you, but it's regular. I've got some friends, the same kind of thing. We, as soon as we finish the call, we put the next date in. This is for my overseas friends. We put the next meetup date as well. That is how you then move those friendships even more along the timeline of warmth, so that you get even closer. It's a great idea.
And all that, the research on your website, you know, when you see it written down, people with close friendships have lower levels of anxiety and depression, increased levels of meaning and happiness, decreased risks of dementia, Alzheimer's, heart attacks. We live for around 7 years longer if we have close friendships. I'm like, this is a no-brainer. We should be investing in this stuff.
Exactly. It's exactly right. There are incredible benefits, and we haven't even talked about the shaping benefits then. I mean, the fact is that the friendships that we have help us to be the people we're supposed to be. And again, we've got an absolute genius on this in the Christian church, because if your goal is to help me as a friend, and my goal is to help you as a friend to become more like the Christ shaped you, then we are both going to help each other do that. We're both going to have the freedom and the joy that comes from being more Christ-like. So, you know, it's friendship with a goal, with a purpose. We help each other to grow. And that's one of the most amazing things. We are all part of our very being is because we've been shaped by the people around us. And, you know, we want to make sure that those are good people around us.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.